This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we continue our coverage of the Israeli-U.S. genocidal assault against the people of Palestine.
Our guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Chris Hedges, who joins us to update the situation in Gaza. His recent book is titled A Genocide Foretold, Reporting on Survival and Resistance in Occupied Palestine. We then take a look at the MAGA ideology with returning guest, Monthly Review editor John Bellamy Foster.
We'll discuss his recent Monthly Review article titled The MAGA Ideology and the Trump Regime.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild. The world looks on in horror as Israel continues its genocidal assault on the Palestinian people. According to Benjamin Netanyahu, and I quote, "The only inevitable outcome will be the wish of Gazans to emigrate outside of the Gaza Strip." He told this to his lawmakers at an elite closed-door meeting. And he continues, "But our main problem is finding countries to take them in." According to our guest today, Chris Hedges, the Israeli war in Gaza marks the end of a world where humanitarian law, conventions that protect civilians, really matter. In a recent piece, Hedges claims that the genocide in Gaza is part of a pattern. It is the harbinger of genocides to come, he writes. It puts to rest the lie of human progress, the myth that we are evolving morally. Only the tools change. Where once we clubbed victims to death or chopped them to pieces with broadswords, today we drop 2,000-pound bombs on refugee camps, spray families with bullets from militarized drones, or pulverize them with tank shells, heavy artillery, and missiles. So we've invited Chris Hedges to join us today to discuss the situation in Gaza and what he claims it portends for the future of relations between the peoples of this world. Chris Hedges is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author and the former Middle East correspondent for The New York Times. Among his books is A Genocide Foretold, Reporting on Survival and Resistance in Occupied Palestine. Well, Chris Hedges, a warm welcome back to Law and Disorder Radio.
Thank you very much.
Chris, in a recent writing of yours, you claim that Gaza's present situation was foretold long ago. You also recently interviewed Amy Kaplan, author of Our American Israel, The Story of Entangled Alliance. So talk to us about this notion, your contention, really, that Gaza's history was long ago foretold.
Well, you know, I spent 7 years in the Middle East and much of that time in Gaza covering the Israel-Palestine conflict. And the antecedents of the current genocide have long been part of Israel's essentially DNA. In 1948, a series of massacres and the displacement of roughly 750,000 Palestinians. And then in the 1967 war, another 350,000 Palestinians were displaced. But in between those conflicts and after that, there was a kind of slow-motion ethnic cleansing, which I covered. With the rise of Netanyahu, his father was a member of the Herut Party. The Herut Party came out of the Zionist terrorist groups, the Irgun and others, and always called for the seizure of all of historic Palestine. I also had covered Meir Kahana, which Meir Kahana is lifted up as this radical right-wing figure, which was the heir of Vladimir Jabotinsky, who Mussolini, and I quote, called a good fascist. This kind of strain of fascism was always in the Zionist project. Life for Palestinians under liberal Zionism was not much better than under this current fascistic Zionism, the difference being that, like Trump, they're kind of more open about their intent. So what we saw on October 7th essentially greenlighted this final effort to drive the Palestinians out of Gaza. And if they get away with it, and it looks like they will turn on the West Bank. But that's always been part of the Zionist project.
Chris, what then do you believe will be the most likely outcome of the Israeli-U.S.-supported genocide assault on Gaza and elsewhere in Palestine?
Well, everything changed on March 2nd with the enforced starvation. And that, of course, means that there's very little time left. They have set up these woefully inadequate, quote-unquote, feeding stations in the south along the nine-mile border with Egypt to lure Palestinians, who are hungry, of course, like mice into a trap. I think that there's a supposition among many of us, much of that area is just a fence between that and the Egyptian Sinai, and you create this mass of desperate humanity, and they just essentially burst through fence. The fact that Israel is just refusing to allow any food or humanitarian aid in other than this kind of symbolic, you know, there's, what, two or three feeding stations, and of course there's been riots, not unexpectedly, with over 20 people shot and killed. I mean, the whole thing is very cynical, and no one's doing anything to stop it. I mean, the United States just vetoed a ceasefire resolution at the UN. So you've seen the rhetoric change out of Europe with Starmer and Macron and others, but of course they're still funneling the weapons to perpetuate the genocide. So I think our fear is that we're probably weeks away. If food is not let in, there is really very little time left.
Chris, you've written in one of your reports that, and I quote, "In fact, genocide is the currency of Western domination," close quote. Talk to us about that assertion. What's the evidence for this?
Well, history of colonialism is colored by a series of holocausts, not many of which are acknowledged by the Western perpetrators. But if you look at in India, I mean, the Bengal famine of 1943, 3 million Hindus died in the famine. Churchill, you know, airily dismissed their deaths by calling them a beastly people with a beastly religion. You saw genocides in Namibia, what is modern-day Namibia, with the Herero and Namaqua, the Armenian genocide, the genocidal project of the conquest of the Americans. It is kind of baked into the DNA, but it's not acknowledged. We acknowledged, Ami Cesari in Discourse on Colonialism says that the Nazi Holocaust was acknowledged because it's essentially the white man, in his words, carried out the tactics that it had used, and I'm quoting him, against the coolies in Africa, the Arabs in Algeria, or the blacks in Africa, against fellow whites. And that's why you've just seen very little sympathy in the global South, or I would say among Native Americans, of course, which suffered their own genocide, or black Americans, with this notion that somehow the Holocaust that was carried out by the fascists in World War II against Jews is unique. It's not unique. In many ways, what Israel is doing is simply a reflection of what we have long done and long countenanced. And of course, we are full partners with this genocide. Israel would not be able to perpetuate this genocide without the huge infusion of stockpiles of weapons, because they've run out of their own, that are given to them by the United States.
So, Chris, you believe, and you've written, that we're entering into a new dark age. Why do you believe this? What's the evidence for the new dark age?
Well, I think that the prosecution of the genocide has kind of ripped back the veil, exposed who we are, all of the efforts by the Global South. I mean, Israel and the United States can rarely muster more than 10 votes of support. It sent a very ominous message, especially as the climate breaks down and you have climate refugees. We already have them crossing the Mediterranean, fleeing north along our own border, the watchtowers, the drones, the statelessness, the detention centers. I mean, all of this is as familiar to migrants, whether coming into the United States or coming into Europe, as it is to the Palestinians. And as the climate disintegrates, I think the message that the global north is sending to the rest of the world, these kind of climate forces, is that we have everything, and if you try and take it away from us, we will kill you. And that's why I think you've seen such impassioned responses within the Global South, because what this genocide is doing is setting a very frightening precedent, which says that the rule of law, humanitarian law, none of it matters anymore.
Well, and the very same report that Michael asked you about You also claim that Gaza puts to rest, is your quote, Gaza puts to rest the lie of human progress. How so? Human progress in what sense?
Well, the idea that's peddled, you know, that we're progressing towards a more enlightened, more just, a more equitable world. And, you know, by the way, this is something that Netanyahu keeps arguing, that we're not moving towards open liberal democracies, we're moving to the opposite, which is why, of course, he makes his alliances with figures like Viktor Orban in Hungary or the far right, including Christian fascists in the United States. No, I think the idea that we're evolving into a more perfect society is, I don't think it was never true, of course, but I think it's been imploded by what's happening now.
Chris, you've written that, and I'm going to quote you, "We cannot, having provided billions of dollars in weapons to Israel and persecuted those who decry the genocide, make moral claims anymore that'll be taken seriously." And I think that's a profound insight, and I wanted you to elaborate on that, please.
Yeah, because the whole idea that we are the defender of human rights, that we care about the rule of law, all of this has been exposed as a lie because of, I mean, we're 20 months of this genocide, which has been live streamed around the world. And yet we remain not only a full partner in the perpetuation of the genocide, but a partner in the repression and blocking of any entity that seeks to disrupt or decry the genocide, whether that's students on university campuses or Yemen, of course, which is disrupted, the only country that's actively intervened to halt the genocide, the disruption of maritime traffic. And, we have to be clear, the Arab regimes are culpable with the disruption of maritime traffic. You've seen a kind of land corridor created by the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan. I was in Jordan last summer, lines of trucks going into Israel. And then I just came back from Egypt, but have been in the Middle East quite a bit since October 7th. And the rage on the Arab street, understandable rage, not only at Israel, not only at Western governments, which aid and abet the genocide, but at their own governments, who at best are passive, if not complicit, in carrying out the genocide. So, you know, we have alienated, along with Israel, most of the globe, and what we're going to see is blowback. We've already seen it with the assassination, killing of the young embassy employees, Israeli embassy employees in Washington, the incident in Boulder, Colorado. This is inevitable. I don't condone it, obviously, but that's what happens when you slaughter, dispossess. I mean, you know, we have traumatized an entire generation of Palestinians, and we're going to pay for it. Unfortunately, this will be a gift to figures like Trump that will use these kinds of acts to accelerate the imposition of an authoritarian state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, Chris, you've also written that in the face of the present condition of the human race, and I quote, "to trust in the fairy tale of human progress to save us is to become passive before despotic power," close quote, and that, quote, "only resistance defined by mass mobilization and by disrupting the exercise of power, especially against genocide, can save us." Why do you believe this is so? And what form must the mobilizations and the disruption take if we're going to be effective, do you think?
Because, let's take the United States. Neither of the two ruling parties have any intent of halting the genocide. They're both complicit or full backers of the genocide. So it's up to us. What does that mean? It means holding to account the weapons manufacturers, the places where these weapons are produced. It means not loading weapons onto ships that are bound for Israel. These kinds of activities are the only way at this point we're going to halt the genocide, because the Trump administration, like the Biden administration, has no intention of doing it. You know, the lesson of the Holocaust is not that Jews are eternal victims, but when you have the capacity to stop genocide and you do not, you are culpable, and we are all very, very culpable.
Mm-hmm. But to follow up on that a bit, I get the impression that your belief is that the mass mobilizations, and goodness knows there have been a number of those mass mobilizations against Trump and, of course, also on behalf of Gaza, but that alone isn't going to save us. We do need something that is more disruptive of state power. By that, what are you thinking of?
Well, actively intervening to prevent the machinery of genocide going forward. I mean, you've seen it in the UK with protests at Elbit Systems. I'm not even saying it's going to work, but it's the only thing that's going to work. You know, the Trump administration is not going to get a conscience any more than the Biden administration had a conscience. I mean, the cynicism of the Biden administration was perhaps even worse than the Trump administration, in that we now know from reporting that although Biden called for a ceasefire, he did absolutely zero to push Israel to implement a ceasefire. You know, this is the defining issue of our age. And there was a great book by Omar Haddad, who's a very fine writer, called, you know, One Day Everyone Will Have Been Against This. I don't see the point of all these Holocaust studies, which proliferate on every university campus. I mean, the fundamental message was lost. It's never again. It's never again for everyone. And yeah, we're going to look back at this moment in history with deep, deep shame and regret.
Israel, and for some time now, but certainly as a result of what it has been done in Gaza now for the last couple of years, has become a pariah nation, really, for much of the rest of the world. Is that not also happening to the U.S. as well?
Absolutely. I mean, we like Israel, have become a pariah nation. That isolation and, you know, legitimate rage that is directed towards Israel and to us is reconfiguring the world and actually empowering other centers of power in this multipolar world, including China and Russia. So the backing, the full-throated backing of the genocide is ultimately, of course, horrific for the Palestinians, but it's not good for the United States or ultimately for Israel itself.
And also, I'm wondering, too, with Trump in power and what we've seen Trump do with the power just in the first 4 or 5 months that he's been in office, is it not fair to say that U.S. fascism is moving along at a heading, a disturbing pace as well? How do you see that?
Fascism, which was always embedded into the Zionist project, also is embedded into the DNA of the United States. You had groups like the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s, a huge resurgence, because it mirrored the rise of fascist movements in the 1920s. You know, Nazis were embraced by American eugenicists who lauded the goal of racial purity and openly disseminated Nazi propaganda. Charles Lindbergh, who accepted a swastika medal from the Nazi Party in 1938. You had these pro-Hitler groups like Defenders of the Christian Faith, or the Silver Shirts, and the initials SS were intentional. The veteran-based khaki shirts. They were just a few of these openly fascist organizations. And just as in Israel, this fascist strain is now ascendant, unfortunately, for us, for the Israelis, and for the Palestinians. But it's always been there.
Chris, yesterday at the UN Security Council, there was a vote 14-1. The United States vetoed a proposal for a ceasefire. And I was thinking, you know, this is just the latest move in the destruction of that body of international law that was set up after World War II, starting with the Nuremberg trials against the Nazis, the UN, and the various instruments to try to rein in the future, set up a structure for peace. And that seems to me that that whole structure has been demolished, including especially what's happened with Gaza. I wanted your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what's so frightening. Any pretense of the rule of law is gone, because, of course, we are in violation of many of our own laws, the Leahy Law, the Genocide Convention, you know, everything else. Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's a really frightening moment. It is a way of just imploding. Now, not those laws were particularly honored with our imperial wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and it going back to Vietnam, but at least it was held out as an ideal. That's finished.
Yes. Chris, you made the point earlier that you just returned from a spell in Egypt. What was your main finding there? What impressed you the most, do you think, from that trip?
Well, I went with the cartoonist Joe Sacco, who is the author of Palestine and Footnotes in Gaza. Both of us spent significant time in Gaza, and we went to interview Palestinians who have left Gaza and are in Egypt to write a book lifting up their voices, different from the book that I just published, A Genocide Foretold, which is really about trying to put the genocide in context. But that is a fully reported book. Joe will draw panels. We did a book together called Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, written out of the poorest pockets of the United States, and we will replicate that format. But I think for both of us, it's about countering this project of erasure, not just the physical erasure of the Palestinians, of their community, but also a cultural and historical erasure. And this is our contribution to make sure the voices of these victims are not erased.
Chris, give us any last thoughts that you may have at this point, please. And also let our listeners know where they can find your many writings.
Well, I think one of the most distressing things for me is how the lie that those who oppose the genocide, and I'm thinking particularly of these courageous students at universities, are supporters of Hamas or anti-Semites. And the press did us a huge disservice, as did university administrators, because they gave credibility to this lie. And I was in these encampments. I mean, on Friday night, the students were putting down tarps, and the Muslim students were saying their prayers, and the Jewish students were saying Shabbat on the same tarp. This is the society we want to create. And the perpetuation of that lie essentially now allows Trump to carry out his war against universities in particular. In many ways, these institutions handed Trump or handed the bullets to their own executioners, you know, going down to Washington and groveling before Stefanik and all of these figures. And just as the universities failed us, the press failed us. The New York Times, for instance, when it reported on the Columbia encampments, raced off that to the Hillel House to find Jewish students who felt uncomfortable. Meanwhile, students were being attacked with chemical spray by Columbia students who'd served in the Israeli Defense Forces. 108 were arrested. People like Catherine Frankie were removed from their jobs, a law professor who'd been there 25 years because she spoke up against this kind of repression. It's really, they misread power, these institutions, and were paying for it. And I think that part of that is just the failure or collapse of these institutions to have find the moral courage to name reality. And these students have paid a horrific price. I mean, the students who have spoken at these commencements and then their degrees are withheld or they're not allowed to graduate. It's a really frightening time when the criminal activity of the state is allowed to shut down those voices within the society that call for, in essence, the rule of law. I mean, that is the definition of tyranny.
And their excuse, is it not, is that the slogans and the very presence of these encampments and the demonstrations that are pro-Palestinian are somehow anti-Semitic, which would seem to stretch the concept of anti-Semitism beyond all meaning.
Yeah, well, you know, in the end, it's not really about anti-Semitism. It's about destroying the left. I mean, this has just become the canard that's used to destroy the left. I mean, Trump's cabinet is filled with neo-Nazis. I mean, and his supporters spew anti-Semitic garbage like Hagee and others, this Christian fascist. Even in this recent bill on anti-Semitism, there was an exemption. You couldn't call people who blamed Jews for the crucifixion of Christ anti-Semites. Well, I graduated from divinity school. That's just not even historically correct. So, and the far right, the anti-Semites on the far right are not targeted. No, it's a total subterfuge which is used by people who could care less about anti-Semites or care less about Jews to destroy the left and the liberal class. Anybody who stands up and supports a pluralistic, inclusive society. And that's what's happening in the name of fighting anti-Semitism.
Well, Chris Hedges, before we are forced to say goodbye to you, we run out of our allotted time. I wanted to remind our listeners that you've written a book called A Genocide Foretold, Reporting on Survival and Resistance in Occupied Palestine. I just wanted to read the shout-out that you have from Atef Abu Saif, the former Minister of Culture of Palestine. And Atef said, Chris Hedges profoundly describes exactly what is happening in Palestine and talks on behalf of the victims. In his painful writings, he makes their voices heard. Well, you certainly do. It's a beautifully written book, Chris, and I hope that our listeners go out and get it. Seven Stories Press, Chris Hedges, A Genocide Foretold. And Chris, before we say goodbye, can you tell our listeners how they can follow your work and your Substack and your broadcasts?
Yeah, chrishedges.substack.com. So both the broadcast and the columns are on the Substack.
Excellent. Well, thank you again for joining us once again on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chris. You take it easy.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Times in history when nothing happens for decades, and other times when decades happen within days. This is what V.I. Lenin observed, and he should know. He was the leader of the Russian Revolution, which overthrew the feudal Tsar and changed the history of the 20th century. We are living in a time when history is unfolding very rapidly. Trump and his coterie of the upper 0.1%, aligned with the mostly lower middle class MAGA movement, have taken huge steps upending and overturning the kind of democracy, however limited by race and class, that we have lived with since gaining our independence from England 250 years ago. We are experiencing the transition to a new absolutist executive. Trump and the ideologues who have shaped his MAGA movement is a president who acts on the premise that whatever he does is lawful. He claimed full power to close down departments like the Department of Education, impound congressionally authorized spending, deport people without due process while ignoring the courts. This is what he calls a unitary executive. The classic definition of fascism is that it's one of the political forms that capitalism may assume in its monopoly imperial phase. It has a material foundation in a tenuous alliance between sectors of the extremely rich monopoly capitalists and a mobilized lower middle class. The key to fascist rule is the privatization of large parts of the government on behalf of the monopoly class. This ideology is now ensconced in the White House. The right wing is opposed to environmental governance. They don't believe in climate change. They're against open borders, universal health care, and green energy. Those who advocate for these beneficial movements are called cultural Marxists. They refer in a derogatory way to all contemporary progressive political causes. They call it woke. They use the term as a means to belittle all social justice struggles against racism and inequality. Its most common usage is as a racist dog whistle. These fascists want to secure their rule by getting control of the entire cultural apparatus of society, a process the Nazis, the German fascists of their time, called bringing it into line. The current attack on universities is the most recent example. We speak today with returning guest John Bellamy Foster. Foster is a professor emeritus of sociology at the University of Oregon. He's a prominent scholar on ecology and the author of many books, including Trump in the White House, Tragedy and Farce. Professor Foster is the editor of the venerable socialist magazine Monthly Review and the author of the article The MAGA Ideology and the Trump Regime, in its most recent May 2025 issue. John Bellamy Foster, a hearty welcome back to Law and Disorder Radio.
Pleased to be here.
John, you understand what is happening in the United States. You've written that, quote, "We're experiencing the transition to a new absolute executive. It's a process of unfolding neo-fascism," end quote. You write that fascism is one of the political forms that capitalism may assume. What are the characteristics of fascism in the United States?
Well, I think we have to go back to 2008, at the time of the great financial crisis. And there were three things that happened at that time from the standpoint of the ruling class or the oligarchy. One was the great financial crisis itself, which threatened a complete meltdown of the system and enormous losses to capital, both in the United States and globally, which was a frightening prospect for those at the top, especially. The second thing was that in the context of that crisis, there was a revolt of a kind coming from mainly from lower middle class, small property holders, small investors. And they formed what we call the Tea Party revolt and all of that at that time. And it became clear that the lower middle class, predominantly white, could be a militant force in the society that could be mobilized. The third thing that happened, although it wasn't apparent fully for maybe a year, was that the Chinese economy was affected by the crisis momentarily and then leaped back up again to an enormously high rate of economic growth, while the entire West and most of the world was in negative growth. And that signaled that China was a threat to the capitalist system in a new way they had not perceived before, that Chinese economic growth was almost unstoppable. So these three things came together in the viewpoint of the ruling capitalist class: the danger of financial meltdown and severe economic crisis under present circumstances, that monopoly finance capital was vulnerable, the threat of China, and the fact that there was a potential to mobilize a lower middle class. And all of this set the stage for the development of what we call neo-fascism in the United States, and which is basically an alliance between monopoly capital, finance, and lower middle class, predominantly lower middle class, which is mobilized to transform the system. Movements in the fascist genus are not an entirely different system. It's the antonym of fascism isn't socialism. Rather, fascism is a form of regime under capitalism that is aimed at the destruction of liberal democracy, which is the normal political regime of capitalism. And so it's a very dangerous phenomenon that only emerges in times of severe crisis.
Well, John, Trump and his MAGA movement claimed that the president could, well, close down government departments like the Department of Education. They claim that they can impound congressionally authorized spending, ignore court decisions, all based on the power of the executive. Are they saying that whatever the president does is by definition therefore lawful?
Yeah, that's the general tendency. In fact, the major theorists of MAGA, people like Michael Anton and Curtis Yarvin and many others I could note, were saying precisely that. If Trump was back in office, he could operate as Caesar. In a fascist-type regime, neo-fascist-type regime, they claim to adhere to the Constitution, but they interpret the Constitution, and this was even true for Nazi Germany, an earlier form of fascism, They claim that the Constitution allows the executive to have singular power to the executive to control the society in general. In Nazi Germany, there was what we call the Führer principle. They declared that whatever the Führer did was law. And there's this tendency to say that whatever the executive, in this case Trump, does is law. So they say that although Congress allocates funds to various programs, the executive branch or the president has the power to zero out those funds, to eliminate the funds altogether. Not necessarily the organization that's set up, but to remove the funding, which then is effectively to eliminate the organization. They also claim that there is what's called a unilateral executive. I mean, the first principle, zeroing out the funding, is called the impoundment principle. It's a constitutional theory. They also have a constitutional theory called unilateral executive that says that the president has authority over the independent agencies, that they're not really independent, so that the Federal Communications Commission, the Federal Transportation Commission, even the Federal Reserve Board are not really independent in the sense that the unilateral executive gives the president complete authority over them. So, and then there's various provisions for declaring national emergencies. And there are various laws, like, as you know, the Anti-Sedition Acts or the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, which give enormous emergency power to the president. I mean, the president always has martial law authority, but the president is interpreted as having the power to declare emergencies in all sorts of areas, which allow the president then to transgress the law and even the Constitution. So all of these powers are being enlisted, creating a constitutional crisis, because what is happening is that the separation of powers is being eliminated and everything is being concentrated in the executive.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm here with my former law partner, Jim Lafferty. This is Law and Disorder Radio. We're speaking with John Bellamy Foster. John, the right-wing ideology of the MAGA movement is against what they call cultural Marxism. What do they claim is cultural Marxism?
So there are all sorts of attacks on cultural Marxism. And really, the way they define it is they say cultural Marxism is not like original Marxism, which they see as a form of economic determinism. That isn't correct, but it doesn't matter. The what they call cultural Marxism, they say started with Antonio Gramsci in Italy and then spread to what's called the Frankfurt School, that thinkers like Max Horkheimer and Theodor Adorno and Herbert Marcuse, and spread into the United States and led to approaches like critical race theory and gender ideology and so on. And they claim that cultural Marxism dominates not only the universities, but also the government, and that programs like DEI and critical race theory, DEI means diversity, equity, and inclusion, those kinds of programs, critical race theory and so on are all part of cultural Marxism. They say cultural Marxism is the theory behind woke, to which they attribute all the faults of the society. And they say cultural Marxism dominates the administrative state, the state apparatus in the United States. So they had to destroy the administrative state to destroy cultural Marxism. This isn't just the Project 2025. When they issued the executive order at closing down federal spending a week after Trump came into power, they, in the executive order, it says that they are attacking cultural Marxism. And all of the executive orders include charges like this.
Well, John, you've written in Monthly Review that the new fascism in the United States is based on a, and I quote, tenuous alliance between sections of the monopoly ruling class at the top of society and on the immobilized army of a lower middle class adherents from below, close quote. Is this kind of alliance characteristic of all fascist movements?
Yeah, fascism got redefined by liberal theorists, and particularly in the 1980s, as just some kind of extreme racist, revanchist ideology that and it got defined in purely ideological terms. But the original understanding of fascism, if you go back to the 1930s, was the Marxist class-based understanding of fascism as a political formation, which was really kind of a universal understanding of fascism, so that Franz Neumann's Behemoth, which was a Marxist analysis of fascism in Hitler Germany, was used in the Nuremberg trials. The classical notion of fascism is class-based, and it's based on a notion of an alliance that is formed, a political alliance between the monopoly capitalist elements or monopoly finance capital at the top of the society, particularly sectors of that, but perhaps the monopoly finance capital class as a whole, and the petty bourgeoisie or lower middle class of small property owners and lower level white collar employees and rural workers and so on, that a sector of society ends up being mobilized by big capital to combat liberal democracy and what is seen as the political elites. But the lower middle class is also is mobilized not only against the upper middle class, but also against the working class below it. It does not generally attack the capitalist class itself. So you have this alliance, a very dangerous alliance, where the lower middle class, which tends to be nationalist and racist and so on, especially if operating on the basis of their own ideology, and revanchist in the sense of claiming that they want to restore an idyllic past, that class sector is mobilized by the capitalist class against the liberal democracy, against the upper middle class or professional managerial strata, and against the working class. And in the MAGA ideology, it isn't the capitalist class that's the ruling class in the United States. It's actually the administrative state and those who control the administrative state, which means for them, the upper middle class and the working class are really upper middle class elites, and the working class control the administrative state, which is geared to their needs and not to either capital or to the lower middle class. So it's a very dangerous phenomenon because of this link between billionaires and this very disenchanted lower middle class that is afraid of falling into the working class and feels oppressed by the state.
John Bellamy Foster, you have predicted that the billionaire class at the top will ultimately betray the base. Why is that? And is that happening already?
It is happening in various ways. This is the nature of fascism. It's this alliance between, let's say, the billionaire class today or monopoly finance capital and the lower middle class. And, of course, it tries to target mass of the working class and the poor and to target what they see as the liberal elite or the professional managerial class. But it also ends up targeting MAGA movement itself and the lower middle class. The MAGA movement, for example, you know, you have people like Steve Bannon who don't want the immigration preferences for that are given to employees from abroad that corporations bring in. They see that as anti-American and opposed to. But Trump always sides with the billionaire class when there's that kind of direct conflict. And so we see people like Bannon being pushed aside. So the radical MAGA is always kind of being betrayed. We see a situation now where with the high tariffs, this is going to strike Trump's lower middle class followers. And even the cuts in Medicaid will affect them. The high inflation rates will affect them. The Trump latest answer to high inflation rates is to discontinue the statisticians within the government, statisticians who construct the consumer price index. They're no longer going to be allowed to go into the grocery stores to check on prices. By eliminating the data, they can sort of downplay the amount of inflation in the society. The whole attack on the working class actually flows over into attacks on the lower middle class. It's the interests of the oligarchy or the billionaires that is dominant here. And Trump, you know, actually presented himself as a peace candidate, but the capitalist class, the global monopoly finance capital, U.S. style, is headed more and more towards war to maintain its hegemony. So the MAGA ideology is being betrayed in some ways. The MAGA movement is being betrayed in all these different sorts of ways. And this will result in more repression, especially you can expect a repression of those elements, those radical MAGA elements that defy Trump.
Well, John, you predict that the next chapter in this fascist program is to get control of the entire cultural apparatus of society in the process of what you write, and I quote, the Nazis called bringing it into line, close quote. Would that include everything from public broadcasting, critical legacy media, independent media like the stations affiliated with the Pacifica Foundation, including stations that, well, broadcast our show, Law and Disorder?
Yes, of course. This is a product not just of Trump, but of the whole MAGA movement. First of all, the nature of fascism or neo-fascism, as we can call it in this case, to gain control by way of what the Germans called Gleichschaltung, or bringing into line, synchronization. They can't defeat all of their enemies in a headlong assault, but what they do is threaten and undermine institutions, and are able to do that by getting the liberal elements, those who ostensibly stand for a liberal democracy and that aspect of capitalism to back away, to simply for their own safety or in order to adapt, they give in stages. So this is the strategy. The strategy is first to take over the administrative state, to or eliminate the administrative state, as they call it. Then to go after the entire cultural apparatus, which is part of the state, or sort of the level of civil society that's tied to the state. They're going after education and the media are major targets. So the attack on Harvard, for example, is part of an attempt to gain control of the cultural apparatus, leading MAGA theorists like Rufo, but this is really part of the overall ideology to break down. The universities are seen as hotbeds of cultural Marxism, critical race theory, DEI. So they have to be brought into line by threats and punishment and getting them to agree to the Trump program. And the media is obviously a target too. In the first Trump administration, they actually tried to go after the media right at the start. You can remember Bannon's actions, for example. But they've been a little bit slower in attacking the media this time around. But that's the goal, is to get the media to conform, to fall into line, to stop questioning, not to fight back, but to hedge and back away and pretend that they're not part of the Trump project, but simply acceding with everything it does. Now, if you look at the big, beautiful bill, they also inserted a provision to eliminate funding for nonprofit corporations that in some way defend terrorists, right? And according to the definitions of the executive, any organization, any media organization that supports Palestinians in the context of the Israeli genocide in Gaza is liable to lose their nonprofit status. But also the notion of the universal executive, the idea is that the Trump administration can use the FCC if it wants to eliminate the license of any media organization. So we're going to see threats along that line, and the media, the media will basically, since they're profit-making corporations, most of them will go along, while left media may simply be crushed because they can do that. So we have this looming threat. The entire cultural apparatus is in danger. They're removing Black exhibits, the exhibits on Black history from the Smithsonian. Trump is moving funds away from the national, from the NEA and the NEH and giving them to his statues of heroes. You know, it's all part of an attempt to change the cultural dimensions of society. He attacks degenerate art just like Hitler did. He has used the term degenerate art. They're proposing to eliminate that and replace that with a nationalist populist art.
Well, John, sadly, we are out of time. But before we let you go, how can people follow your work? How, for example, can they, obtain the monthly review?
Well, monthly review is easy to find. You just have to Google monthly review and it pops up right away. And monthly review exists in a print edition as well. It's designed really for a print edition. And you can find all the information on the monthly review site as to how to subscribe. We also have MR Online that provides daily information. So monthly review is very available. It may not be visible in the media, but we're definitely there and easy to find.
Thank you very much, John Bellamy Foster. Thank you for being our guest on Law and Disorder Radio.
Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
Mm-hmm.